stop me.
I'm just means here.
Everybody on the phone, I think I'm recording this conference call. So just to let you know, one person said that they couldn't make it, and since I was going to record the hearing anyway, I just thought I'd record the whole meeting and make that audio file available. So just so you know.
Okay.
We can take turns.
Yeah.
She falls asleep the first.
Give you enough support, that way everyone doesn't tire of the voice.
We're going to start in a minute, everybody. Someone just stepped out of the room, so as soon as they come back, we're going to get started. Our lights just went off. Okay, let's get started so we can get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Jillian O'Hara, and I work here in headquarters as a rule writer. George Davis is our other presenter tonight. I wanted to do some logistics first for people here in Portland. Bathrooms are over by the elevators. I would like to do introductions from the different offices to see who's online. Maybe we can start here with telling your name and who you're from, what company you're with. Also, a little bit of a warning, the microphones around on the table, they can pick up paper rustling. So if you could be a little bit careful so the people on the conference line don't hear a lot of paper rustling. So, George, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm George Davis, permanent writer in DEQ's Northwest Virginia office and part of the rulemaking team.
I'm Gary Andes. I'm out of the DEQ Salem office, permit writer, inspector also, and also was part of this team.
Yeah, did we go around, we introduce ourselves to them?
Okay. Please.
Tom Woods, Reeves, and AOI.
John Krallman, Neighbors for Clean Air.
Christina Lavelle, EORN.
Bill Sweeney, Northwest.
Peggy Ketchum, the Building Company.
Catherine Bonetta, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association.
How about Pendleton office, please?
This is Doug Welsh, DEQ Pendleton office.
Norma Job, Ashgrove, Durkee.
Jake Devine, Smith Frozen Foods, Weston.
Thane Jennings, Calpine Corporation.
That's it.
Okay, how about Ben?
Oh, this is Walt West, permit writer in Bend. At this time, we don't have anyone here, but they could show up any time now.
Walt, if no one shows, feel free to leave, okay?
Okay. I do think that some folks might show up.
Okay. Medford office?
Yeah, this is Tom Peterson, permit writer and inspector, and we also have no one from the outside yet.
Okay. And Lane Regional?
This is Merlin Huff, El Rapid director.
Max Heffley, permit writer.
Jeff Davis, permit writer.
Dana Lee from Roseburg Forest Products.
Randy Jones, Johnson Crushers International.
And Robbie Lanier from El Rapa.
That's it.
Okay, thanks everybody. We're gonna hold, so we've got this presentation divided into sections, and there's time for questions at the end of each section, so if you wouldn't mind waiting till we get to that question slide to ask your questions, that would be helpful. Okay, so the reason we're here today is to tell you about our proposed rule changes. Some of you have already heard this presentation, but we changed it a little bit in hopes that we wouldn't put you to sleep again. Originally, this proposed rulemaking started out as a cleanup, but it expanded when we looked at our rules and thought about all the things that we need to fix. We nicknamed it the kitchen sink because it includes so many diverse things. It also has some minor changes to our wood stove program and the gasoline dispensing requirements, but we're not going to be talking about those tonight. We're just going to be talking about permitting requirements. I'm on the next slide, everybody on the phone. The goals of this rulemaking were to make sure our rules are clear, up-to-date, and that they address their quality problems. When we address their quality problems, we want to make sure we're targeting our resources at the right place. We want to provide incentives to reduce emissions where needed and provide companies flexibility as long as it will improve air quality. Next slide. This is our rulemaking schedule. We started public notice on June 16th, and I hope all of you got the notice that we extended the public notice by 2 more weeks, so we will go until August 14th. Well, tonight we're having our public hearing. We will go to our commission for rule adoption early January, and then we will need to do a SIP submittal to EPA soon after EQC adoption. Next slide. This is an overview of what we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be talking about the rule cleanup. We have a defined term, categorically insignificant activities, that we'll go over. We'll talk about how we're updating our statewide particulate standards, grain loading, and opacity. We'll talk about how emissions are divided or combined when a business splits or combines. We'll go over changes to our new source review, our pre-construction permitting program. We'll talk about how we are changing our rules to provide for extensions on new source review permits. We also have another term, net air quality benefit. We'll be talking about changes we're proposing to those rules. And last but not least, we're going to talk about the recent Supreme Court decision on greenhouse gas PSC permitting and Title V permitting. So we'll go over all of these in more detail. And by the way, this presentation is available online. It's at our permitting website. If you go to air quality permitting, and if you, it's kind of at the top of the page under the news. I think it says current news. There should be a PDF of that, of this presentation there. That's available. Next slide. So the first part of this presentation, we're going to talk about rule cleanup. Some of our rules are out of order, so we wanted to move them to the right place. There are procedures and the definitions, for example, major modification, actual emissions, and netting basis, so we wanted to move those to where they belong. Some of our rules are missing important details, so we worked on clarifying those. For example, some of our standards don't have compliance determination methods, so we included those wherever possible. We also wanted a clean set of definitions. Throughout all of our definitions, all of our divisions, we have multiple definitions of the same term, and of course, they're different definitions. So we've consolidated all the definitions, and we're putting them in division 200, unless it's a division that's just for, unless it's a definition, excuse me, for just one particular division. So we left those there. But otherwise, we pulled everything into division 200. We're fixing cross-referencing errors and typos. And with all of these cleanup changes, they will not be affecting the stringency of our program. Next slide. As part of our cleanup, we wanted to repeal some rules. The spray paint rules were part of a plan to reduce ozone from consumer products. When EPA adopted national rules that apply to manufacturers, we no longer needed the state rules. And then the other rule that we're repealing is the Western Backstop SO2 Federal Trading Program. DEQ was working with the Western states on an SO2 trading program, but dropped out because it wasn't cost effective. There are specific rules, but PGE isn't involved in trading, so we don't need the state rules anymore. So we're going to get rid of those. Next slide. These are some more rules that we're going to repeal. Unfortunately, many businesses have shut down in Oregon, so we're going to repeal those industry-specific rules. Neutral sulfite semi-chemical pulp mills, sulfite pulp mills, primary aluminum, laterite ore production, and charcoal. LRAPA will still maintain the charcoal rules in their county for their charcoal plant. So all the other industry-specific rules are staying the same, including the craft pulp mill rule. So if one of the businesses in any of these industries does want to build in Oregon, they would have to comply with the federal standards, which are more stringent than our current state standards. Next slide. Oh, where'd my question slide go? Oh, because this is part of it. Never mind. Okay, I'm on track. The other thing we're talking about tonight is categorically insignificant activities. We'll go over the background, the proposed changes, and whatever regulatory considerations are the result of these changes. Next slide. So when we developed the Title V program, businesses were required to account for all of their emissions, no matter how small. And we knew we didn't want to deal with really small sources of emissions, so we came up with this list of categorically insignificant activities. And they are, some examples are janitorial activities, groundskeeping, instrument calibration, maintenance and repair. I counted them, and there are 58 of those activities in our rules right now. Right now, how we have it set up is if a facility has any of those activities, all they have to do in their application is say yes or no whether we have them or not, and we'll include those in the review report. Other than that, we don't care about them. We don't want to know how their emissions are. It's just, you know, they're insignificant. But we found out that some of the activities that we have on this list really aren't insignificant or they have rules that apply, so we need to propose changes to those insignificant activities. Next slide. So like I said, some of the activities are subject to EPA standards. EPA adopted national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants for reciprocating internal combustion engines, and those added requirements for emergency generators. So we had to make some changes for that. And we also found out that some emissions from these activities were not insignificant when you aggregate all the emissions. If they have a lot of those activities, they could really add up. So we put some thresholds in there. Next slide. For emergency generators, currently they are considered insignificant, no matter how big they are or how many they have at a facility. We're changing that to if an individual engine is rated at less than 500 horsepower, it will still be insignificant. And if the emissions in aggregate are less than de minimis levels based on 100 hours of readiness and maintenance testing, we will still consider those insignificant. If they're greater than those thresholds, then they will have to go into the permit. They'll have to be permitted. Or they might, wait, I'm jumping ahead. So those are the criteria for insignificance still for emergency generators. Next slide, small fuel burning equipment. Again, right now we consider them, if they're below these thresholds that we have, we consider them to be categorically insignificant no matter how many they have. And we're changing that. We're keeping the same thresholds, but we're saying that if they have, if there's a whole bunch of them at a facility and their emissions are greater than our de minimis levels, then they would also need to be included in a permit or notice of construction or whatever. We had one facility that had, was it 20 of these small guys? 8, 10, 20? And their emissions, I think the NOx emissions were about 14 tons. So they weren't really insignificant when you aggregate the emissions. Next slide. So these are the regulatory considerations when we're making these changes to these activities. Some may require a notice of construction. Some may require permits, like the data centers have, you know, huge emergency generating capacity. So they are, they're pretty much all permitted. And then the other thing we need to think about is what to do with the plant site emission limits when we add these activities. You know, of course, if those, these things existed in their baseline, then we would need to add them to the baseline and the PSCL, but if they didn't, we would just add them to the PSCL. So we need to work on that. We'll need to get emissions from businesses to see what these activities might be. Next slide. I kind of jumped the gun on this one, too. So again, we'll be adding them to PSCLs and baselines where appropriate, and we'll probably be doing it at the next permit renewal. But if we do add those activities to the permits, we're going to make sure it's not going to trigger other requirements, like, you know, no one would trigger a new source review just because we're adding emergency generators to their facilities. So we'll take that into account. Okay? Next slide. Now,
questions.
Any questions on categorically insignificant activities? John?
So you're saying that the change in the rules will not trigger, you're not going to have that trigger PSD at this time, but down the road, would any other physical change, if the PSCL is increased because of this rule change above new source review thresholds, any subsequent physical change at the facility would trigger PSD?
Yeah, it could.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a one-time exemption because what you have rules, not facilities, not making a change. We're changing the rule.
Any questions on the phone?
Could you go back to the two slides?
This one?
Yeah.
I'm on slide 13, people on the phone.
Hey.
What's the determination of whether or not an agency meets is required or not? Is that changing?
No. We have a kind of a catch-all category that if emissions are 10 tons per year, regulated air pollutants, 5 tons per year per PM. If they exceed those thresholds, they would need a permit. If they don't, if all they have is emergency generators and don't exceed those permitting thresholds, they wouldn't require a permit.
Okay, so that's just in relation to the emergency generators.
Right.
Okay.
If somebody already has a permit, then these would be added to the permit.
Okay, thank you.
So if they, George, if they don't have a, they don't trip the 10 catch-all, they don't have an NOC requirement?
They do.
so they have no permit, but they still have to go through permitting.
Are the thresholds for the state rules that you're appealing and the federal NSPS the same? So, you know, they apply to the facility at a certain level. You know, are those thresholds the same? So, for instance, could the state rule, is the capacity, so the triggering capacity is 10 for the state rule, is the NSPS 10 as well? Or, I mean, the NSPS is more stringent, but the state rule, would they cover sources that would not be covered under the NSPS, is what I'm asking.
I don't think the NSPS really has
thresholds.
But it might have a size capacity. So, you know, the facility has to be more, have capacity more than, you know, 300 million barrels or something like that. But what's the matchup between the state rules that you're planning on repealing and the NSPS? So a new source that's cited in, could a new source be cited in Oregon that would be subject to the state rules that are, that you're planning on repealing, but wouldn't trigger NSPS?
I don't know the answer to that.
You're talking about the sulfite mill, the old sulfite mill.
Yeah, I mean, all of those categories that there's no longer a source that's in Oregon right now. You're saying that we don't need these rules anymore because NSPS takes care of it, but does it actually take care of it because the threat, you know, it's more stringent if you trigger it, but are you always going to trigger it?
They would always trigger new source review. Those facilities would.
Most likely.
Okay.
From the emissions.
Yeah, I can't imagine them not building in Oregon and not triggering. They're pretty big.
Those are big looking facilities.
Yeah, because those are all Title V permits, so I think they would trigger. But that's a good question.
Yeah,
to think about it that way.
Yeah. I don't know if we have size.
I'd also recommend putting this presentation on the rule change website as well as just your permitting website.
You know, I tried to do that, and they're pretty they're sticklers about what goes on that rule change website.
Okay.
That's why I had to have that extra website for the supporting documents. They wouldn't even put those there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I tried for that. Any questions on the phone?
Nope.
Okay. I'm going to slide 16. I wanted to go over some of the changes we're making to the Division 216 table. We are kind of changing some of the categories. We're deleting grain terminal elevators, and we're going to just use grain elevators instead. We're adding recreational vehicle manufacturing to manufactured home and mobile home manufacturing. We're separating pathological waste incinerators from crematory incinerators. We had kind of an issue come up with that. People were thinking that crematories could burn pathological waste, and they cannot. And we're also creating this new category for stationary internal combustion engines. Again, that's the result of EPA's rights to chef. So if they meet the thresholds on that, then they have to get a permit. Next slide. We're also creating a catch-all for portable sources. We tried to clarify which of those categories where we would permit both stationary and portable sources. So things like asphalt, concrete paving plants, concrete manufacturing, rock and concrete or asphalt crushing, and then soil remediation facilities. So those would all be stationary and portable, but we are creating this catch-all portable. It's similar to our other catch-all category that we have in this table.
So basically, because we're specifying that certain portable facilities have to get a permit, this allows us to also require a permit for a portable facility that's not in one of those categories that we feel would need to have a permit on that.
Next slide. Okay, any questions on the general rule cleanup? Anybody on the phone?
Still here, no questions.
Bill, I actually had one question. The engines, you said they're moving onto the table.
Yeah.
Where are they?
It should be Part B of that table.
Right. Number 87 in Part B. On that side of the page. Okay. Next.
Okay. Next slide. This is, we're going to be talking about our changes to our particulate matter and opacity standards. We'll do the background, the proposed changes, the implementation schedule, the affected sources, and some compliance issues. Next slide. So our standards for grain loading, which is our particulate matter standard, and our opacity standards, they were adopted back in the early 70s as part of our state implementation plan. And at that time, we had two standards. We had standards for pre-1970 sources and post-1970 sources. And the pre-1970 sources were, we call them, we kind of grandfathered them in. They had 40% and 0.2 grain loading. The sources that were built after 1970 have 20% and 0.1 grain loading. So since that time, since we adopted those standards in 1970, things have changed. We've got much lower national ambient air quality standards for particulate. Back then it was 260, and now it's 35 for PM2.5. So the standards have changed quite a bit since we initially adopted these standards. And we also found out that our standards are inconsistent with how EPA, with EPA's policy for significant figures. So we're also changing those in this proposed rulemaking. Next slide. I'm going to talk about opacity first. We're going to change all of our opacity standards except recovery furnaces. We're going to change them to 6-minute block averages. Right now we have 3 minutes and 60 minutes. And we're going to go to, again, 6-minute block averages. We are going to be using EPA Method 9 instead of our DEQ Modified Method 9. This is a change consistent with how other states have been handling their opacity. We found out that we're the last state in Region 10 to do this. Everybody else has already made this change. So, and we don't think that it's going to change the stringency of these opacity standards going to a 6-minute block average. Next slide. We're going to be repealing the Portland 4-county standard, the 20% opacity for 30 seconds for non-fuel burning equipment. Again, this is only in the, it only applies in the 4-county area. One of the reasons is we don't have a standard method, a reference method for that. We've been using a really modified method 9 for that. And it's not part of our STIP, so EPA didn't have any opinion on this. And those units would still be covered by our statewide opacity standards. So they still have an opacity limit they have to meet. Next slide. So we're going from 40% opacity for the pre-1970 sources to 20%. We will be maintaining 40% for grate cleaning operations for hog fuel boilers. They have to develop a grate cleaning plan to minimize emissions, and those plans have to be approved by DEQ. For compliance, we are going to defer compliance with 20% until January 2020 if businesses are not located in sensitive areas. So if businesses are in non-attainment or maintenance areas or our proposed sustainment or reattainment areas, if they are located in any of those areas, then they would have to go to 20% upon rule adoption. And if they're not in those areas, which is most of the state, then they'll stay at 40% until January 1st, 2020. Next slide. We're also changing how we're regulating fugitive emissions, opacity for fugitive emissions. So, you know, as you know, it's very difficult to read opacity from a fugitive emission source. Instead, we are going to require that businesses abate fugitive emissions that escape through work practice standards, and we're not going to try to determine if they're a nuisance, and we're not going to try to read 20% on these sources, on these fugitive emission sources. We'll be using EPA Method 22, and again, if there are fugitive emissions that escape for more than 18 seconds in a 6-minute period, we will require sources to abate the emissions, or tightly enclose or ventilate a building, and develop a fugitive emission control plan. So we think that's going to be a more effective way to regulate fugitive emissions. Next slide. So now we'll move into the grain loading standard. Again, we're adding a significant digit to the standard to be consistent with EPA's policy. And we are going to be phasing out the 0.2 standard for the older sources to help address newer and tighter ambient air quality standards. We found that even though most of the areas that are very close to or exceeding the PM2.5 standard, it's due to wood stoves, we did an analysis of a source in Klamath Falls, of a single source. So this source had 40% in 0.2, and when we did the modeling on that source, we found out that that source alone, if you include the background, that source took 70% of the NAC, of the ambient air quality standard. So even though we're finding exceedances of the standard in the wintertime, at night, at our monitors, industry still has, you know, industry still contributes to those exceedances. Next slide. So these are the proposed grain loading standards in this table. I'm on slide 26, everybody. So I'll just read across on the table. So anybody, any sources that we have sourced this data that's less than 0.08, whether they're pre or post-1970, those guys are going to 0.10. They can operate at 0.08 regardless of what limit they have. To operate at highest and best, we feel that they can meet 0.10 easily. So that's what they're, that's the standard they'll be getting, and that will be effective on rule adoption, upon rule adoption in January. For sources that were built before 1970 that don't have test data less than 0.08, they will stay at 0.2 until 2020. And in 2020, they will be, their opacity, their grain loading, excuse me, will be reduced to 0.15. And the little asterisk there, if the source cannot meet 0.15, they can ask for a source-specific limit of 0.17 grains per dry static cubic bit, per cubic foot, but it also has to be supported with a report from a registered professional engineer stating why they can't meet 0.15. So they'll have to do maintenance, maintenance, possibly upgrade. And if they still can't meet 0.15, then they could possibly get 0.17. For sources that were built after 1970, they're at 0.1 right now. Again, they'll stay at 0.1 upon rule adoption, and this looks really weird, but they're going to get 0.14 at 2020. Basically, they have 0.149 because we don't have, there's only one significant digit. So we would consider, if a source test came in at 0.149, we would still consider them to be in compliance with 0.1. So we're going to add the significant digit and call it 0.14. So they are, it's status quo for those guys. And then for facilities or equipment that is not used more than 876 hours, they have 0.2 now. They will continue to stay at 0.2, and they will go to 0.20 in 2020. So that's it. That's it for green loading. Next slide. So we feel that the proposed changes to the grain loading and the opacity standards are proactive measures to help prevent violations of the standards, of the PM2.5 standards. And hopefully that would prevent us from areas from becoming nonattainment and having to meet more stringent standards in the future. These are similar to more stringent changes that we adopted when we had PM2.5 nonattainment areas. We did those as reactive measures. For example, Medford, we had to adopt much lower standards in the Medford area because of the PM10 non-attainment area. Next slide. So there are approximately 11 wood-fired boilers that are going to be affected by this rule, the grain loading changes. Many of them that can comply with 0.15, but not all the time. We have a pretty wide range of test results from 0.06 to 0.21 grains per dry standard cubic feet. And we met with all of these businesses, and I think they're okay with what we're proposing. Next slide. So what might be necessary to comply with the new standards? Conduct more frequent tuning and maintenance, more frequent inspection and maintenance of control equipment. Most of them have multi-clones on. They would need to maintain a consistent high-quality fuel and also possibly improve combustion control. Next slide. Anybody have questions on the PM standard? John?
Can you go back to the table that you had?
Oops. Oh, dang it. How do I do that?
Thanks.
Okay, I'm on page 26, everybody.
So if I'm reading this correctly, the only sources that will get another significant figure before 2020 are those that are you have source test data for.
Source test data less than 0.0.
Less than 0.0, yeah. But other than that, you're not going to add the any significant figure until 2020.
Right.
Okay. And then
there is a provision for a one-year extension, too, John. Did you notice that?
I haven't gotten all the way through all this.
Okay. Yeah, we did provide for if people need it, we're going to allow them to request a one-year extension on that compliance date.
Okay. And then the other thing was, it's not necessarily about this, but did you look at any of your other standards to see whether they were consistent with EPA's significant figure policy, to see whether there were any others out there like this that only had one significant figure when you're going through all this, you know, the kitchen sink rule?
Did we? I don't remember. That's a good point. We will do that. I really don't remember.
Yeah, actually, a lot of that work was done by our now retired colleague, Mark, so we think they're all 2 digits now, except for the big one.
But I will check. Thank you. Good point. Yes?
Marla Nelson, I have a question about, so what is the basis for the 2020 date?
5 years. We're giving sources 5 years to comply.
Right, so what's the basis for 5 years? Is that just the standard?
We thought that was, no, wait, don't, which rules have 5 years?
I mean, I know DT uses that a lot, but.
Did we choose that for, was it for similar, there was a reason. I think other standards gave sources 5 years to comply.
For new,
I'm sorry, we haven't done this in a few months, so
right. We're kind of rusty. Okay.
All the MAC standards you can use would be a 3-year compliance.
BART gives you 5.
BART gives you 5.
But those are for standards, like if you're, because these are bringing them up to compliance that maybe should have been done earlier, right? So I don't know if that makes, I'm just wondering what the base for.
Should have done it earlier?
Well, we're getting things back into consistency with EPA standards, right? Versus a new rule by EPA that's requiring DEQ to adjust their rules as a brand new thing, which would maybe phase in something new. I just was wondering if it's the same, if you're using the same 5-year standard for both kinds of changes.
We're just using it for this. For the grant and opacity.
Right.
So do you think that's too short or too long? Oh, that's okay. You don't
have to. I'm just wondering if there was a reason for it, like if it was set by some other.
I'd have to look that one up.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm also wondering why you don't add the significant figure right away to, and you don't have to make it zero, but 0.24 is, I mean, that's what the compliance, you know, if they're above 0.24.
Yeah.
You know, they're not in compliance, so why not just add the significant figure right away so that you're consistent with EPA policy, you know, now instead of 5 years from now?
Okay, that's a good point. Anybody on the phone?
Yep, we're still here.
I'm not sure what I'm hoping to do.
Okay, let's see, where are we? Oh, I'm going the wrong way. Sorry. Combining and splitting. We're on slide 31. And George is going to take over.
Okay. So I'm going to be talking about the rest of the changes we're proposing to the program, starting with the combining and splitting rule. And the combining and splitting rule was first created back in 2001. basically because we had a little bit of experience with a source that wanted to split up, and so we needed to create some rules to cover that. And it doesn't get used very often. In fact, it may not have been used at all since 2001, but we've had questions around it. So we felt we needed to make some changes to it while we're in the process of this rulemaking. So the combining and splitting source rule addresses how the netting basis is handled when sources combine or split, if the source has netting basis. So we want to clarify that the original source or sources and the resulting source or sources have to have some common primary or secondary two-digit SIC codes. And the reason for that is because our definition of source hinges very much on SIC codes. So we want to, basically we want to try to maintain the integrity of the source as defined by SIC codes. And then in a split, we're also clarifying that netting basis that's assigned to the resulting sources can't exceed the potential to emit of the devices or the emission units involved. So in other words, a source could not split off a piece and assign far more netting basis to it than it needs, because that would provide an opportunity for a source to basically then expand and avoid new source review. Basically, we're trying to minimize the number of sources that can avoid new source review. So that's the only slide on that topic. Are there any questions?
The hippies comment.
Nope.
Okay. Then going to slide 33. New source review. So a very quick background. New source review is a pre-construction permitting program mandated by the Clean Air Act. It's designed to maintain and protect air quality, and it requires the installation of pollution control devices when certain requirements are met, when it's appropriate. There are, in essence, there are three distinct programs that are part of new source review. One of them is prevention of significant deterioration, or PSD, which applies in attainment areas. There's non-attainment new source review, and then there's a third program called minor new source review. And the first two, PSD and non-attainment NSR, together are typically referred to as major new source review to distinguish it from minor new source review. So next slide. There are some things that are unique to DEQ's program. Our major source definition in non-attainment and maintenance areas has a lower threshold than EPA's definition for major sources. We also have differences in our requirements for offsets and net air quality benefit. The EPA program only requires offsets. They define net air quality benefit as offsets. We have additional requirements that involve air dispersion modeling. Next slide, 35. Other things that are unique, we require air quality impact analysis for minor sources. And we define maintenance areas. Maintenance areas are formerly non-attainment areas that have come back into attainment. Our program is more stringent than the federal program because the feds just have attainment and non-attainment. But once they come back into attainment, they're attainment. We keep maintenance in place. We have a little bit more stringent requirements to hopefully prevent the area from sliding back into non-attainment. Excuse me. Slide 36. So why are we proposing changes? One reason is because there are areas of the state that are close to or are exceeding the PM2.5 ambient air quality standard. And those standards, of course, were adopted in 2007. They're much lower than the PM10 standards. And we're finding that there are areas that have problems with PM2.5. Those areas are, as Bill mentioned earlier, caused mainly by area source emissions, typically wood stoves. Our current rule structure doesn't really adequately address PM2.5 ambient air quality problems, and it also basically prohibits development in areas that have PM2.5 problems. Slide 37. So we're proposing changes to try to improve this. Basically, we want to allow for development in those areas, but we also want that development to help improve or maintain, at least maintain air quality. And basically, we believe that new or modified sources can indeed help to address the problems. And make that clear in a moment how that works. Okay, slide 38. So the changes, first change we're making is to align our definition of major source with EPA's definition. Basically, currently we define major source level at the significant emission rate or higher. We're proposing to raise that up to 100 tons per year. And there will be different requirements for small and large sources, small sources being under 100, large sources being over. We're also proposing to create two new area designations. And the motivation there is to help prevent areas from going into non-attainment if they're having problems but they aren't currently designated non-attainment. We want to keep them from becoming non-attainment if possible. We also want to eliminate a permitting roadblock in our rules and hopefully get, if an area is in non-attainment, to help them get into a maintenance designation faster. These changes will primarily affect minor new source review. Major sources we have less flexibility with major sources because we are constrained by the federal program. And as a result, things don't really get any easier for the major sources. But for the minor sources, we're trying to make it possible for development to occur. Slide 39. So this table shows one of the changes we're proposing here. And this is looking at major and minor new source review, current and proposed. The upper part of the table shows that for non-attainment and maintenance areas, facilities are subject to major new source review, currently subject to major new source review, if they have emissions at the significant emission rate or higher. And what we're proposing to do is to change that threshold to 100. That's the lower table. Then a facility that had emissions of 100 tons per year or more would be subject to major new source review and significant emission rate up to 99, they would be subject to minor new source review. And less than the significant emission rate, basically, they currently don't have any requirements to meet, and we're not changing that. Overall, we're keeping the stringency the same. Even though it looks like things are changing a lot from major to minor, we've structured the rules so that the requirements that are in place today really remain in place. The next slide basically shows the attainment areas, which is the area where PSD would apply, and we're not proposing any changes for attainment areas or PSD thresholds. That was slide 40. Moving on to 41. Two new area designations. We're proposing to create two new areas. One is called a sustainment area. Its purpose is to help keep an area from becoming non-attainment. And the other area designation would be reattainment. And the idea is to provide a little bit more flexibility in the rules to allow smaller sources to expand or build, but still be protective of air quality. So these changes, the two new area designations, kind of work in combination with our changing the threshold for major new source review to allow development in areas that have air quality problems. Slide 42. Currently, there are three area designations possible in the state, starting with the green area. We have attainment areas where air quality is below the ambient air quality standards, basically good air quality. If the air quality decreases or goes above the standard, then the area could be or should eventually be designated as non-attainment. And then hopefully once the area comes back into attainment, it would shift over and be reclassified to maintenance. Next slide. The problem occurs in that it takes quite a long time to change those designations. And we end up with situations where an area may be classified attainment. That's that upper gray slide, upper gray area. It's still classified as attainment, but the air quality is actually worse than the ambient air quality standard. And that puts that area into a funny position within our rule, because they have to meet the rules for an attainment area, but they can't because the air quality is above the standard. Okay, so basically it creates a permitting roadblock there. We have it's a different situation when going from non-attainment to maintenance. The big problem there, again, is simply that once the air quality has improved and we're into the redesignation process, it still takes years. Facilities still have to meet the non-attainment requirements. And so by creating or by what we want to do is make it a little bit easier for the smaller sources to get to maintenance requirements a little faster, okay, if the air quality has improved enough to where we know we're going into maintenance.
George, regarding that, would you envision that the department would have a statewide map that would be flashing colors for, over times every year, starting January, okay, here's where you are, and that is that, non-attainment or your sustainment attainment, what is the time frame that it takes to get there? Is it 1 week? Is it 6 months? Is it a year that it reclassifies? So that a source can be predicting, we want to add a process change. Today we're in sustainment, but then all of a sudden January 1, you've redesignated it as reattainment. All of a sudden that changes the whole permitting process for that facility.
Yeah, that's a good question. excuse me. The process to designate an area as sustainment or reattainment would involve going to the Environmental Quality Commission. They would have the authority to do this. So it would be a rulemaking process. Rulemaking can take anywhere from 6 months to 6 years. but if it were being done as a separate action, then it would probably move on the faster track. But I think that's the best answer I can give you, is that it's tied to the rulemaking process.
It only allows a year.
Yeah.
Well, the attainment. The non-attainment designation has to be basically formally ratified by EPA.
Right.
That's what really takes a long time. The sustainment and reattainment designations are an internal DEQ, EQC thing only. And EPA doesn't care about it for a moment.
So if the area is in non-attainment and the department says it's now in reattainment, but EPA has not moved it to maintenance, is that process allowed?
Yes.
Your program says you're non-attainment, you have to follow the non-attainment rules. And so EPA, which is what your issue is, how the EPA or the maintenance, you're saying here's the step in between that our rules support.
Right. The way that works is because these are state designations, they are basically overlaid on top of EPA's designations. They don't replace EPA's designations. They don't supersede them. So in this example of a sustainment area, sustainment is overlaid on an attainment designation. Okay. And that's where we get the split between the major and minor sources. The major sources effectively are still dealing with the attainment area rules because that's where the federal program requires that. And so they're kind of stuck. They're stuck in that limbo, and we can't really do anything about it. But for the minor sources subject to minor new source review, we can, because EPA's program doesn't deal with those sources. They tell us we have to have a minor new source review program, but they don't specify what it has to do. Okay, so the flexibility comes in with the smaller sources. as an overlay on a team. Okay? So does that make some sense? And the other, and reattainment works the same way. It's an overlay on non-attainment. So for major sources, they're still considered to be effectively in a non-attainment area. They still have to comply with those regulations. But for the smaller sources, subject to minor resource review, we can shift them toward maintenance faster. Okay. So these are think of them as overlays. They don't replace the federal designations.
We also have to work with the local community.
Right.
We're proposing Lakeview as a sustainment area, but that's something that, after we explain the process to them, that's something that they requested. The county commissioners, government people, they got involved in requesting designation as a sustainment area.
Right. And so it would probably be, you know, our anticipation is if this happens again, it'll be driven by the community. And, that, of course, DEQ wants to work with the communities, so we'd probably try to make the process as fast as we reasonably could. So looking again at slide 44, those transitional areas that were shown in the gray are the two new area designations, basically. So a sustainment area would be an overlay on attainment. And the hope, the idea is that under the sustainment designation, it would be possible, we hope, to get back into attainment without having to go into non-attainment. Okay, so we're going to tighten things up a bit and make things a little more stringent. But it also makes permitting possible, whereas today it's impossible. Okay. Reattainment, again, is a little different. It's an overlay on the non-attainment, and it just kind of eases some of the requirements on the smaller sources, provided that air quality has already reached attainment levels but hasn't been officially designated by EPA yet. Okay. Yes, Catherine.
George, is part of your... Well, actually, I think you're covering it here, so let's go to the next slide. Your area sources, is part of your goal to be able to have more flexibility with area sources if area sources are driving the bus, so to speak?
They get pulled in a different way. Area sources are something that we typically either don't regulate at all, like household wood-fired heating devices, or they're small businesses that are regulated fairly lightly. These rules really won't affect them. The rules don't change for them. But I'll talk a little bit about what we call priority sources, and that's kind of how we anticipate or are proposing to pull area sources in. So I'll just continue, and hopefully it'll make sense. Okay, so again, priority sources. We've defined them as the sources that are primarily responsible for poor air quality in an area. Okay, in Lakeview, for example, it's wood stoves. Right, they are the primary thing that causes the community to go over the ambient air quality standard. And within the permitting program, we've tried to provide incentives for a new source or an expanding source to reduce the priority source emissions, right? And basically, we've done that by giving them more credit for emission reductions that they obtain from the priority sources. Okay, so they have to get offsets within these areas. If you get some of your offsets from the priority sources, you're helping to solve the problem. You also get a little extra credit for getting the priority sources as your offset, or part of your offset. Okay. And again, specifying priority sources is done by rulemaking by the Environmental Quality Commission. Okay, slide 46. We're also proposing to change the offset requirements in some areas. For major new source review, some of the ratios would be higher than current. The current ratios are 1 to 1, so we're proposing to boost those up to 1.2 to 1. The minor new source review offset ratios are typically lower than the major new source review offset requirements. They are area specific now. and they can be reduced if a new or expanding facility gets its offsets from priority sources. Okay. One of the reductions, for example, would be to reduce the ratio from 1.2 down to 1 to 1. There are not proposing any changes to ozone offset requirements. Slide 47. We're also proposing changes to the net air quality benefit requirements. Basically, at this time, the net air quality benefit criteria are nearly impossible to meet. Again, that creates a permitting roadblock in communities that are trying to achieve economic development. We're proposing to revise those criteria. We still want to be protective of air quality, of course. We want to focus on the areas that have the worst air quality and prevent further degradation in the area. And we want to reduce the emphasis on industrial emission offsets where area sources are the main contributors. Again, that comes back to the getting offsets from the priority sources. And we also want to eliminate the impossible criteria. We want to make it possible for a source to come in as long as it meets the criteria. Slide 48. So to summarize the proposed changes, we're proposing to change the major source threshold, major new source review threshold, to 100 tons per year in non-attainment and maintenance areas. We're proposing to create two new area designations, sustainment and reattainment, to identify priority sources, to revise the offset requirements, revise the net air quality benefit requirements, and as an organizational thing, we're putting state new source review, we're creating what we call state new source review, which is basically a reorganization of the current rules and putting that into Division 224. Okay, so Division 224 will now include both major and state new source review. State new source review is essentially minor new source review. Okay. So next slide, and any questions on all of that? No questions. Good. Let's move on. No.
In looking at the designation for sustainment and reattainment, it looks like you're only submitting the authority to designate to the SIP, but you're not submitting any other parts of those regulations. I wanted to know why you weren't. I mean, only pieces of that is planned to be submitted to the as part of the SIP. So I wondered why you didn't submit the rest of it. So there's three sections for the designation of sustainment and reattainment areas. One is EQC has the authority to designate those areas based on these conditions. The second one is these are the areas, and the third one is the designation will be changed upon these actions. Only section one is being submitted to this as part of the SIP. Sections two and three are not. And I just wanted to see if you knew why any of it is being submitted in the first place, and if any of it's being submitted, why all of it's not being submitted.
We are just submitting that one rule that EPA as part of our SIP, and we talked to EPA about it. Like George said, the designation is going to affect federal major sources, so that's why we only submitted that one rule as part of our SIP. EPA, I think they told us that they didn't care what areas were going to be sustainment or reattainment. They just cared about how we did it.
Well, I think one of the problems I have is that the authority is there to designate it, but then the regulations that redesignate it are not being submitted as part of the SIP. And I just wonder how that would work given the functioning of how the SIP affects state law. For areas that you're designating sustainment, are you going to ask EPA to hold up? Let there be light. Are you going to ask EPA to Region 10 to hold off on a non-attainment classification if there's one in process while you're waiting to see whether sustainment works, or are you expecting that the designation of a sustainment area will not affect the way EPA's process in designating non-attainment areas is affected?
I think we don't expect it to change EPA's process or how they deal with it. But what we're finding, for example, in Lakeview is that EPA is trying to work with the local community to address the problem. And they're apparently, and I hesitate to speak for EPA, I'm not trying to speak for EPA, but they don't seem to be in a big hurry to designate it as a non-attainment area. They would like to see if local efforts can show improvement and make a difference. There's, I forget the name of the program that they've got going there.
PM Advance,
right. Okay, so we kind of see this working along the same lines, but we don't anticipate going to EPA and saying, hey, we've designated this sustainment, please back off on non-attainment.
Okay.
Where does the change from the FCR to the 100 tons show itself on the major source definition? You said that was being changed, but it's not being changed in the major source definition itself.
No, it's being changed in the federal major source definition.
Okay.
Did everyone hear that?
Can you summarize it?
Tom asked where the change from the significant emission rate to 100 tons per year as the split between major and minor new source review, where is that change actually being made? And the change is made in the definition of federal major source.
Okay, thanks.
I noticed that a lot of the justification obviously has to do with PM areas because those are the areas that are causing issues right now, but did you guys consider how this kind of process would work in areas in the future that have non-PM 2.5 related issues? So, for instance, the change to the ozone standard affects Portland, how that plays out in an area besides one that's impacted by wood stoves?
I don't think we've really played it out. I think the focus is kind of on PM because that's where we are seeing the issues. We're aware that the ozone standard may change. And I think we could do the same thing. The designation of priority sources is an action all by itself, and the commission would not have to actually create priority sources, or they could, if we were able to identify them. In the case of ozone, that's typically going to be in our larger communities with a much broader, both industrial and area source base, where it might be hard to identify priority sources. We're also not changing the offset requirements, and there's no modeling involved for ozone, so it's kind of a different animal. Any more questions on that? If not, then let's go to slide 50. One of the other changes we're proposing is changes to our extensions for NSR and PSD permits. Currently, the rule allows for the rule says that you have to begin construction within 18 months of being issued the permit, and the rule allows DEQ to extend that time period. Other than that, the rule is pretty nonspecific. We think it needs some clarification. So we're proposing to add provisions that will allow for two 18-month extensions, and there would be no more allowed after that, so a maximum of two. We're proposing to add criteria for approving the extensions. The first extension would be relatively simple. The second one would have a little bit more to be done to get the extension. We're also specifying the procedures that have to be followed to request the extensions and procedures for approving the extensions. We've talked to EPA about this as well. They're also contemplating making changes to their rules.
pertaining to extensions on these permits, and our proposal is pretty much in line with what they're thinking. Next slide, and any questions on extensions? Okay, no questions. We'll go to slide 52. We want to talk briefly about the recent Supreme Court ruling. This case, of course, was Utilities Error Reporting Group versus EPA. And in June, the Supreme Court invalidated portions of EPA's so-called tailoring rule. Basically, what the court says is that sources can't trigger PSD for greenhouse gases alone, but they did confirm that sources that are subject to PSD for other pollutants could be required to perform a BACT analysis for greenhouse gases. The court also said that sources could not be made subject to Title V for greenhouse gases alone. Okay. Next slide, 53. In Oregon, the commission adopted rules in 2011 that basically implemented the tailoring rule in Oregon, but you know, we adopted full rules on this. So the court's action does not invalidate any of our rules. It invalidates EPA's rule, but not ours. So our rules remain in effect at this time. But we're in a rulemaking process right now, and of course there's questions on whether or not we're going to follow the court's ruling or not. So basically, what we're asking for is comments on what you think we should do at this point in time. Should we retain our rules as they are? Should we revise them to agree with the court's ruling? Do you think we should make other changes? So basically, there's no proposal in the rules on this. All right, we're just asking for comments on what you think we should do.
Okay. Do you anticipate making any changes as part of this rulemaking because of the comments you receive, or will there be a secondary public notice where the public will get a chance to actually comment on?
We don't believe there will be a second public notice.
Well, it seems to me that if you're asking can they be changed in other ways, I have no idea what those other ways are, so I can't comment on if someone suggests we, you know, do something crazy and stand on our heads. I'm not going to be able to talk about, you know, give my input into that. Now, if it's just retained as they are or revised to agree with court's rulings, those are concrete things that I can comment on. But the sort of open-endedness of change in other ways doesn't provide the public with an ability or industry with an ability if for instance, you know, Sierra Club or someone else came in and suggested that you ratchet them even tighter in some different way, industry wouldn't have an opportunity as part of this comment period to talk about that. So it seems to me that if it's not one of those concrete things, that there should be another public comment period on any changes associated with this case.
How often do you hear me say I agree completely with John Perlman?
This would be a first time.
Look, this isn't the recorded part.
I know, it's already recorded.
Oh, darn.
Don't worry, I'll bring it up when we do the brown bag.
Well, let me just say that trying to be all-inclusive is seldom a good idea. I shouldn't have put that third bullet on there, should I?
Well, all three of those are legitimate questions, but none of them leave a rule package. None of them say, you know, strike out the following sections or keep the following section. You know, it's not a question for that.
Yeah. No, I understand the point you guys are making. So at this point, I think what you're suggesting is that if we're going to do this, it ought to be done as a separate rulemaking.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, you've asked for comment, so I'd accept comment and then based on that, you know, make your decision and put out another rulemaking notice and give another public comment period so people can comment on the actual proposed rule changes as opposed to sort of this broad idea.
I would say if you're doing the third bullet, if you're doing either the first two, that's stated with adequate specificity to be able to say it's derived, anything changes you make are derived from the rulemaking package. You go off in something that we don't know what it is, then it can't be have been raised with adequate specificity in the rulemaking. Not all rules have language with them. Not all rule proposals.
Gotcha. Okay, point taken.
On the other question, I have to look at the public notice again. The public notice that talk about this at all.
It's
in our slides here tonight.
No, the re-notice asks for public comments specifically on.
Okay. So noted. That's it. Any other comments or questions on that? Then, I think that's it for the presentation. Do you have any further questions? Ask Jill, because I don't know.
Why don't we take a 5-minute break? Could people who have not signed in, please sign in. If you want to testify, you need to fill out one of those little forms over there and give it to me. We'll open up the public hearing in about 5 minutes. Any questions on the phone?
Nope, no questions.
Okay, we'll be back in five. At what time? At 7:20. Thank you.
Could I schedule the end time or long stick?
Actually, my guard leaves at 9 o'clock, I think, so.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have to be out of there by then. No one just can come in by after that. Other than adding the certificate data, so that's pretty important.
nothing to do with it.
Oh, yeah, we've been periodically contacting, and so I just wanted to make sure that this wasn't going to...
Yeah, like Gary said, we have some guests that are all absolutely... But there are so few.
Yeah, the handful of female guests, which they are becoming Title V, are becoming Title V or POC just female guests? Okay, so...
Right.
they will be, but they're not right now. I told you none about it.
That's the definition.
So it's the 100-250 split?
Right.
So if they're not, if they don't meet that, they've got to be about 250.
Under.
Under PSA. Yes, although they could argue that even under the Clean Air Act, this is applied.
I don't know about that.
Well, this is a minuscule amount, actually. Like 300, that's like 1.2.
And I don't know if they're not public, because there is, I'll show you other stuff.
Okay. Well, I was just looking at the numbers that Ron used for the information
transfer. Right, and that's when you say, you just kind of certainty, because they said it would be wrong.
Okay, so they're not used for that. Okay.
But they have questions. I'll get information.
Right, so maybe they are. So, but anyway, that was one of those things. I can't believe I didn't notice that. And I, it was when I was looking through and editing the 50 minutes.
Are you started?
Yeah, we'll last the morning after, so. Everybody still on the line, on the phone?
We're still here in Pendleton.
Yeah, I'm here in Medford, but I'm leaving.
Okay, nobody there. Okay.
This is Wald. I'm still here.
El Rapp is still here.
Okay. Before I kind of get into this canned testimony thing here, I noticed that it didn't look like everybody had signed up on the coming sheet, so if you could please do that before we leave, we'd appreciate it. As far as the actual presenting testimony, anybody that wishes to present comments should fill out the testimony forms and give them to me or Jill. And so far, we haven't got any from anybody here. Is anybody at your sites out in their offices have anybody that wants to testify tonight?
Nobody in Pendleton.
No one in Bend.
None in Springfield.
Okay. Anyway, even if you're not planning to give any testimony tonight, but you want to receive a copy of the final staff report, including what's called the presiding officer's report, you need to indicate that by printing your name and address on the sign-in sheet. That's why I asked you to go ahead and sign that. If you do that, you'll get the comments. Will automatically, you folks will receive the comments and copies of the final staff report. The court is on. So at this time, I would like to begin the hearing. No smoking is allowed, obviously. This hearing is being recorded to maintain a permanent record. Today is July 6, 2014. The time is 7:25 p.m. July 16, 2014. 7:25. We're at the headquarters office of Department of Environmental Quality. My name is Gary Andes, and I am the presiding officer tonight. We've had Jill Unahara and George Davis here from DEQ, who are also on the rule writing team for this particular rules. I'm the presiding officer for this hearing, and as such, I'm here to take comments on behalf of the Environmental Quality Commission, which is the five-member citizens board appointed by the governor. And the commission essentially sets the environmental rules and policies for DEQ, and the department is really staff for the commission. If you do want to present comments again or testimony tonight, you need to fill out the testimony form and give it to us. You can still, as I said before, receive a copy of the final staff report by just doing the sign-in sheet. Again, the purpose of this meeting is to take public comments on the proposed rules known as the Air Quality Permitting, Heat Smart, and Gasoline Dispensing Facility Updates Rule Adoption. The job of me as the presiding officer is to hear and acknowledge comments. not to defend the proposed rules. Following the completion of this public hearing, a written presiding officer's report summarizing both the written and verbal comments will be prepared. Now, the deadline date, as Jill mentioned earlier, for receipt of written comments has changed, and it's now August 14, 2014 at 5 p.m. After reviewing the comments, DEQ may consider revisions to the proposed rules. DEQ's final recommendation for rule adoption is going to be made at the EQC meeting that's scheduled for January 7th or 8th, and the location is still yet to be determined. The Commission will use its own discretion in deciding whether it will adopt all, part, or none of the proposed rules, postpone the adoption of them, or hold additional public hearing. I'd like to begin taking comments, if there are any. If you do have written statements and you're going to present oral comments also, it'd be good to summarize those and just hand in the written material into the record. Now, in the long run, written comments receive just the same weight as oral comments. So just take that in mind. Anybody wants to present testimony tonight here in Portland? Is there anybody out in the other offices that wants to present testimony tonight?
Nope.
No.
None in Springfield.
I guess at this point, there's nobody signed up.
Okay. Do you have anyone to present testimony tonight?
I'm not sure it's relevant to what you presented tonight. I'm going to just write it.
Okay.
Or anyone with my...
Whatever you want to do.
Well, if you're encouraging me to do so, my husband and I came down because we know that you're looking at new rules, and we have a plant going in across the street from our house that has escaped both the usual city permit process and the usual DEQ process by virtue of operating under the same DEQ permit, although that is four blocks away. And we were just interested in how these rules were going to be revised, because it's at a facility that exists that is going to, a building that's going to be retrofitted, which is a warehouse four blocks from the original facility, and is going to be allowed under the same land use permit, if our understanding, and the same DEQ permit without going through the permit process. There will be, of course, an application, but it was without the same process, and we just became very concerned that this seems to be a loophole for the biggest pollutant in Polk County to continue without having public input. So I thought it might apply to what you're talking about tonight, but it doesn't seem to do so directly.
I think I would agree that it doesn't directly. The rule proposals we're making here really don't affect that. That is part of a land use situation and a permitting situation. And we're really not changing what kind of permit somebody needs, except for the few new sources we were adding. So I don't think the proposed rules here really affect what you're dealing with in this issue.
Well, perhaps after this is over, we could speak with you and you could tell us if there's an advocate at DEQ that we can contact, or some informational person that could be more helpful to us. Thank you.
Certainly do that. At this point, 7:30, and nobody's really signed up or in the other offices wanting to present testimony, so I'm adjourning this hearing at this point in time. I want to thank everybody for coming, and expect to see all your written comments by August 14th. Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm leading the charge.
Well, I'll be stepping back.